So it's I'm Bill to give a talk on sex, and talk is too grand a term. Sex might even be too grand a term, actually, but talk's only it. So I'm going to talk for a little while, until I stop talking, and then mainly I'd like to find out what your questions are. Let's just wait until... Come in, you're welcome. There's more seats at the front here. It does mean being seen. Place is here, but it's not comfortable. And the first interesting thing, isn't it, about this talk on sex is that the room is completely full. I'm afraid that says a lot in itself, doesn't it? Lydia Dark earlier on was giving a talk on war, and there was about 20 people, so... it's a good job we didn't do on housing or something, because... you know, if we're going to market it, we'll have to do more on sex, won't we? So it is interesting, though, isn't it? Because obviously it's a subject that a lot of people feel very concerned with. Affects all of our lives, doesn't it? The very fact that we exist at all is because of it. The very fact that it was our particular parents who met and did that particular thing is the cause of the fact that we're particularly here. So, in a way, even philosophically, sex is sort of quite important. It's the very meaning of how we got here. Schopenhauer makes a point, the English philosopher, the German philosopher makes a point that a lot of philosophers have thought about death and the whole issue of death, but they haven't thought very much about birth and therefore sex. And yet, actually, it's the particular meeting of those two people that has brought about the whole experience that you have just now. So, you know, it's philosophically central to the fact that we're here, and it's emotionally very important to us in one way or another, isn't it? When I say sex, I mean sort of sex, love, romance, you know, all hyphenated together. So, it's one of those things that there's an awful lot to say about, and there's also quite a lot of slightly appearing, apparently contradictory things to say about it. It's slightly difficult to talk about, at least in a short talk, especially when I haven't written anything. I'm relying on whatever it is that happens. So I thought I'd start with just sort of, in a way, to get a Buddhist perspective on sex. I don't know that we're going to be able to do that in the next hour, but to start to get one, I need to say something much more principial about what Buddhism is. And then out of that, hopefully, we can start to explore the issues. Sex, love, romance, etc., but particularly sex, is one of those things where we want to say either it's good and fantastic and always good and great, or we kind of want to, in the old days at least, want to say it's bad in various ways. It's either bad if you do it with the wrong person, it's bad if you do it if you're not married. In a way, religion has got itself into a real mess, I think, over sex, generally speaking. It's either wanted to make it into something sanctified and sacred, and that's been backed up by the state, so it's the only, marriage is the only, I think, relationship that's sort of officially sanctioned. So it's either sort of tended to make sex something sacred, something that, I remember when my sister got married, the priest was saying that she's getting, is married with God. So there seemed to be three in a bed, which was a surprise. I don't think he meant it quite like that, but... so there's that tendency, isn't there, with, I think probably all religions, to sort of either make it into something very sacred and special and important, or to say it's something very bad. Something very that you shouldn't be doing. You shouldn't be doing it with people, at least with the people you want to do it. If you are doing it with someone, it needs to be for creating babies reasons only. And probably all religions, I think, have got their knickers in a twist over it in one way or another. So when we start to think about sex, we need to be aware of that tendency to want to say yes or no. And in a way, I think Buddhism always wants to be much more careful and much more subtle about it than that. If you say yes, you create no. If you if you say no, you sort of create, yeah. So mainly what I want to try and do is start thinking about the issues of sex. The trouble is there's so many, it's difficult to talk about it. But I thought I'd just start with a really traditional Buddhist vision of it, and then work out how that might, what that might come from to mean for us just now. So you could say that Buddhism starts in two places. Firstly, and probably most importantly, pragmatically, it starts with us now. It starts with me now in my experience, it starts with you and your experience as you find it, however it is. So however you are just now, Buddhism is starting with that, with your experience, and it's starting with your mind. The Buddha is interested, is concerned, particularly with what's happening in your mind. In a way, that's his primary concern. And his primary concern is to see how are we causing suffering for ourselves and others, and how can suffering be alleviated. That's what he set out to do, was to solve the problem of suffering. And to solve it completely. As a young man, he was reputedly extremely good looking. He was wealthy. At one point he got married, he had a son. So obviously a man who'd had sexual experience. At some point in his life, different, you know, traditions tell it differently, but at some point in his life he sort of really turned towards his life and thought incredibly deeply about the issues that he was experiencing. He really tried to see that he was suffering and that suffering would come of it. So, you know, there's various ways of telling the story, but basically he saw that he was young and, you know, handsome and wealthy and everything, but he saw, right down to the core of his being, that he was not going to stay young, that he was going to get old. He saw that he was healthy and fit and handsome, but he was not going to stay those things. He was going to get ill and unfit and not handsome. And he saw that he was alive and fully alive. He seems to have been a remarkably alive person, both physically and intellectually. And he saw that he was going to die. Now, in a way, we all sort of see those things, but we don't really. We sort of know that we're going to get old. We sort of know we're going to get sick. And we sort of know we're going to die, but hardly in any way that's valuable experientially. Is there a place? Have you got a place?
Yeah, great.
So, I'll just try and see if there's any more cushions around. So we're in a very... It seems that the Buddha, or the Buddha to be in that time, had a quite remarkable commitment to looking at his actual experience and seeing that even if he was happy just now, it would end with somewhere along the line there's going to be sickness, old age and death. He knew that he didn't want to get old, he knew he didn't want to get sick, he knew he didn't want to die. Actually, he's in the same position as we all are. None of us want to get sick, none of us want to get old, none of us want to die. And yet we sort of know it's going to happen, but we don't know it in any effective way. We know it just with the very top of our head, don't we? We sort of agree to it, that we're going to die, for instance, but it doesn't really touch us very deeply. And even sometimes when someone you know dies, you can notice your mind thinking, oh yeah, well they die, yeah, well maybe they're going to die. But I'm living, I'm carrying on, I'm not going to die in some way. There's a wonderful book by Tolstoy, a short story, where called The Death of Ivan Illovich, where it starts with Illovich's death. And Tolstoy describes what's going on in the mind of people around them. And one person thinks, yes, Illovich has died, but I do things better. You know, things like that don't happen to me, I organise things better. And it's brilliant insight into what we sort of do. We sort of think it won't happen to us. Now, it seems that the Buddha-to-be seemed to have had some kind of real realisation that it was going to happen, and that it would happen very soon. I mean, however long it takes to happen, it happens very, very soon. It may happen today. Come in, if you can find a place. it will happen very soon. There's a lovely sutra where the Buddha, they're talking about, like one of the Buddha's disciples says that, you know, human life is so brief it just feels like a few days, doesn't it, however long you live. And another disciple says, actually, it feels even briefer than that, it feels like just like a meal you've eaten. And the Buddha said, no, you've not understood. Human life is just like the time it takes to breathe in and out. So, the Buddha seemed to really understand that old age, death and suffering were right near him, and that there he was in the crown of his life, with a child, with a beautiful wife, according to traditions. One doesn't ever quite know the real facts. So he seemed to have seen through that all it could do was lead to more of that, that life just seemed to be more and more of that. I remember my friend's child being born, and as we went in to see her on the first day of her life, they were wheeling in a very, very elderly lady, and it really felt like, oh, that's the whole circle. And because we're so time bound, we just focus on this little slice, but actually it's just a circle, isn't it? And we sort of know, but strangely we don't. It's amazing that we can live and know about death but not know it at all, even when we've been very close to it. We can know about illness and so on, and sickness and old age and so on, but we don't really notice them. So in a way, the Buddhism starts with us. It starts with the existential facts of our experience. And the great existential fact of our experience is that we're going to die. Nobody seems to mention it, but it is a rather important thing, that we're going to die. And that we definitely don't want to. Our youth, if we've still got it, is going to go. And as you get older, time goes quicker. Do you remember what it was like when you were seven and a weekend seemed incredibly long? Now, a weekend goes before you know it, you know, and so on and so on, yeah. So it starts with us and our existential situation. But it also starts, Buddhism also starts with the Buddha. So the Siddhartha, who I've been talking about, this man who had some insight into really seeing that he was going to die, not just an idea, but right down to his very core, he knew that he was going to die. If we knew that, in a certain sense, that's all you'd need, to fully know that all the way through yourself, and you would change in that moment. You would become a different kind of creature. For instance, you'd never argue again. It's just stupid to argue. You'd never watch rubbishy television. You'd just live, because you knew that you were going to die. And you'd live at the best possible pitch. But we don't live like that. We forget that we're going to die. It's interesting. It's easy, understandable to forget your mobile phone, or to forget your Oyster card or your keys. But we forget the one thing that we actually know, which is we're going to die. Which is really weird, isn't it? When you think of it, our human situation is very strange. There's a seat at the front if you want to sit at the front. There's some cushions here. It might be a bit more comfortable. This is a sex talk, so it's very popular. I haven't got to it yet. So it also starts, Buddhism also starts with the Buddha's experience of becoming a Buddha. So he left, according to tradition, he left home, he left everything, he left his wife and child. Don't get too hung up about that. It's actually in the earliest sutras there's no mention of a wife and child, so actually nobody really knows. It's better to read it as metaphor rather than as history. He left everything, he renounced everything, he renounced his posh clothes, he cut his hair off. He went in search of the answer to suffering. He went in search of finding the cause of suffering, and therefore its eradication. It's complete eradication. Yeah? So he seems to have been someone utterly committed to that search, and that really is what Buddhism is. It's a following in the footsteps of the Buddha in that search for the end of suffering. First of all, it means acknowledging suffering, that we all suffer, and we don't want to, but we do, and even if we're not obviously suffering now, we will. So he tried to sort that question out. We usually won't go that deep. We usually just try and paper over it. We usually just hope another partner, another film, another job, don't worry folks, we'll kind of get through. We'll somehow pull it off. The Buddha to be saw that none of those answers were answers, that they were false solutions. And he saw it around him very, very clearly. Sometimes you can have touches of that, can't you, where you have moments where you look around and you just think, what on earth are we doing? We're sort of rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic much of the time, aren't we? Playing a little sonata, the boat going down, you know. That is our situation. And occasionally we wake up to that a bit. Sometimes I think around midlife particularly, people talk about a midlife crisis, and sometimes it's that you actually start to wake up to the fact that time is not going to be what you thought it was going to be, and that you are going to die, and so much of what you do in comparison with that seems utterly insignificant, like rearranging the furniture on the Titanic. So the Buddha didn't seem to be remarkable in his commitment to solving that problem. He then learnt all different teachings from different practitioners. He seemed to have been remarkably spiritually adept. He was able to meditate extremely deeply, very, very quickly. But even then, realised that the meditations he was being taught, and when you hear them described, they're really, you know, I'd be very, very happy to have those experiences. They're incredibly exalted states that he got into. But he also saw that those exalted states would pass away, that they didn't solve the problems of old age, sickness and death. And that was what he was interested in. Anything else, even so-called spiritual solutions to the Buddha, weren't solutions. They were pretend solutions. So he then left the teachers that he went to. He famously went to two different kinds of teachers, learned a lot about meditation, then left them and went and meditated on his own. And according to tradition, he gained enlightenment, what's called enlightenment. And it's him gaining enlightenment is the great sort of figure of the Buddha. So when we talk about the Buddha is a title. It means awake, literally awake. So in being awake, he solves the problem of suffering. Now I can't tell you what that solution is, apart from it's an experience, and it's experience that completely changes your life. But it's a solution to the problem of suffering, which is the great problem for human beings. In fact, but in comparison to it, there isn't any other problems. One simple way of talking about it is that enlightenment is a complete letting go of all egotism, of the last vestige of egotism. And as soon as you've let go of egotism, you become everything, effectively. You stop being this little separate self that you're so zealously trying to guard and enhance. You just let go of everything, and then everything comes back in this new way, in a way. So the Buddha figure represents the aim, the goal of Buddhism, which is complete, complete solution to the problem of suffering. So when we think about something like sex, for instance, we sort of need to remember those two things. We need to remember, first of all, we're working from our experience up, from our day-to-day experience up. And also, if we're trying to practice Buddhism, we're working from Buddhahood down. We're working from the sense that there is a solution, a transcendental, a transcending solution to the most intimate problems of our life. That there is more to life and more to us than we can possibly imagine. And that much of what we call ourselves is actually a limitation, not a flourishing. The Buddha's trying to say, that the figure of the Buddha is trying to say that there is much, much more that is valuable. Pleasurable is too pale a word. Deeply satisfying, enriching, everything you've ever wanted. That the key to suffering is there, and there is a solution, and that solution makes anything else that you had before that not any kind of solution. Yeah? So that depending where we're standing, thinking about something like sex, depends on where we're standing in this. So if we take the Buddha's point of view first of all, the Buddha would say something like, yeah, fine, you want to have sex, but tell you what, this urge you have, this craving, this need, this wanting, this longing, this yearning, is actually causing suffering. It's causing you suffering. And what you need to do, you need to renounce that. You need to let go of that, because that craving, that yearning, that longing is causing the very suffering that you're trying to avoid. You can't have the causes of suffering and then not have suffering. So it's much easier to think of a really easy example and sort of non-controversial example first. So there's a lovely example I often use about you go and have a meal at a friend's house and they're a very good cook and you're eating this food and you start to experience pleasure. And you have this experience of pleasure. But usually what happens is we immediately want to repeat it, don't we? So we have this experience of pleasure, the food's pleasant, and your mind starts to think about, I'd like more of this, doesn't it? Have you had that moment? Where you're in a restaurant and you think, wow, this is lovely. Before you know it, you think, I'd like to have more. You know? And as soon as you're thinking, I'd like to have more than this, you're getting less, aren't you? Because your mind is no longer absorbed in the pleasure you're actually having, but starting to plan for more pleasure. I remember this, my famous cheese sandwich moment, where, I don't know whether you've ever had this, but I really recommend it. I'd been teaching here at the centre and I was going off on a retreat. It was late night, we decided to stop on the way. I had a white bread cheese sandwich. You know, cheddar cheese, white bread, that's it, you know, the sort of thing I had as a child. And I ate the first triangle and it was fantastic. You know, sometimes food you think, how did you do that? You could worship this, it's the best cheese, you know, it just hit the spot, you know, sometimes, not very often, but sometimes food does that. As soon as I did that, I thought, I want another one. As soon as I thought I wanted another one, I stopped attending to the sandwich I was having. What? Not only that, I started to rush the sandwich I was having to have another one. So that's what we start to do, isn't it? We start to think, I'd like to have more, and then we start to rush what we're having, the pleasure we're having, to have more pleasure, because we want more pleasure. Because we rush it, isn't it less pleasurable? So we've now gone down various notches of pleasure. And then, of course, what happens when the more comes, you've actually eaten quite a lot, so you're not as hungry, so it's not as pleasurable. Not only that, I don't know whether you've noticed this, but you end up feeling slightly anxious that you won't get more. So if you're at a dinner party, you start glancing around at your other guests and slightly racing them. Because what if they have it all, and they have the whole meal, then you can't get more. So you get slightly anxious. Does that ring a bell? You get slightly anxious, and that makes you eat quicker, and that means that you get even less pleasure. Yeah? So the pleasure itself is not really the problem. The problem is that with pleasure, we're automatically wired to repeat it. And that creates pain. I was talking downstairs about the weekend syndrome. I don't know whether you've experienced this, is where you've been working hard all week, so you think, this is my weekend, this has to be wall-to-wall pleasure. So I want sex, and then I want to have a nice cup of coffee, and then I want to read a paper, I want, you know, you try and get this kind of, you know, all the way to a club in the evening, whatever it is you do. You try and squeeze pleasure out of this weekend. It's this awful thing we've created, a week that's supposed to be work or meaning or something, and then a weekend which is supposed to be pleasure. And then you try and squeeze out as much pleasure as you can from the weekend, and what you end up with is pain. You end up feeling excitable, unsteady, you can't concentrate, and so on. Yes? The more you try and squeeze pleasure out of experience, the more you'll be left with pain. And it's just in the nature of things. If you don't believe me, try it this weekend. See if you can feel tomorrow and the rest of today with as much pleasure as possible. So eat as much of that cake as possible, then go and see a film, then have another bit of cake, then have some wine, and then go and sleep with five people, and then go to a club, and then take some eat. You know. And then try and meditate on Sunday morning. Then at the end of Sunday, if it's worked, tell me what you've done, because I'd really like to do it. So the Buddha's not saying, it's not anything religious here. The Buddha's just saying, look at your experience. What happens when you have pleasure? You want to have more of it. So this is a big issue with sex, is that just like having more any pleasure, it's addictive. Pleasure itself is addictive. It's not just sex that is, but pleasure itself is. It's not just sex that's addictive, but it's the whole kind of love thing, isn't it? Sometimes I think I'll spend my whole life just sort of lying in bed hoping that someone will give me a cuddle. You know what I mean? That was slightly nearer to the mark. Anyway, that's obviously true because I've gone very rare. Perhaps I shouldn't be revealing these things, but you see what I mean? That there's Well, it's a part of oneself, at least a part of me, is sort of always hanging around waiting to be loved. It's almost a bit like, you know, when you're a child, you think, I tell you what, I'll get in a big bad mood, and then mother will just come and pick me up. Someone will come and make it all right. And we really hope that our partner will be that someone. And sometimes there's a sort of standoff about who's going to make it all right. You know, you make it all right for me, and nobody, I've had a harder day than you. You have this argument about who's going to be the one who picks you up. So I'll pick you up, then you pick me up. So it's also around love, isn't it? That you, and then, you know, you have sex, you have love, and it doesn't ever quite, it's never quite enough. So I think one of the great tragedies of human life, and one of the things that the Buddha saw so deeply, is that ordinary worldly life gives with one hand and takes away with another. So it's not that it doesn't give you anything. So if you do go out tonight and you get to sleep with five people, that'll probably be very exciting. I hope it is, anyway. Otherwise, why would you be doing it? Anyway, that's another matter. That'll probably be very exciting. If you keep doing that, it'll probably become extremely painful. But anyway, very difficult to organise and extremely costly, but that's another matter. If you're not careful... I've actually distracted myself now. Yeah, so, you know, that'll be very exciting, but you won't feel like you've got love. You won't feel like you've got commitment. You won't feel like you've got someone who's there for you, who sees you in a special way. So you get something. You get risk, you get adventure, you get pleasure, you get newness. There's something about sex with people that you don't know, for instance, that's very exciting, or you don't know very well, the newness of sex. So you get all that, but you don't get the security, you don't get someone who knows you, you can't usually talk in any great depth. So then you decide to have a, you know, straightforward monogamous relationship. You get security, you get comfort, you get so that you can be yourself with them, you don't have to dress up all the time. Surprise, before you know it, the sex gradually dies off. Or you just get very used to it, you get habituated to it, you forget to notice it, you get irritable with each other, and then they leave you and you suddenly feel agonised, you know, and so on. What the Buddha is saying, I think, is, look, life is always doing this in every sphere. It gives with one hand and takes with another. You get security, you don't get excitement and risk and adventure. You get risk and adventure and excitement, you don't get security. When you do get the lover of your life, you get used to it and you fail to notice it. When they leave you, you're agonised and you wish you remembered to appreciate it when you had it. When you don't have a relationship, you really wish you had one. When you do have one, you wish you had more or a different one. Or so it goes on, yeah. The image that we have of walking into the sunset with a lover and everything is perfectly fine is just a story that human beings made up to make ourselves feel better. It's never existed. It's not that you're not particularly good at it, it's just never existed. It can get love and romance definitely gives you a measure of pleasure, a measure of excitement, a measure of love, but it never can do what you really want it to do. The stories we've told ourselves are to make us believe that it can. And we caused ourselves and probably each other a lot of pain in those stories. So in a way, that's looking at it from the Buddha's perspective. So he'd say, from a classical perspective, he'd say, well, you need to go forth from that like I did. You need to leave behind craving. Early Buddhism is incredibly radical. It just says you need to completely leave it behind. The Buddha said that sex is just like drinking salty water. The more you have, the more you want. It's not that you ever get to a place where you feel fine. It never quite does it. And you get addicted to it. And that's also true. It can be true of all sorts of things. It's increasingly true of technology. Any kind of thing that gives you a buzz of pleasure creates addiction very, very easily. From alcohol to drugs to technology to pornography to sex. There's a recent film, isn't there, about sex addiction, for instance. I haven't seen, but... I'm sure that's a very big issue for lots of people. Certainly pornography is. So the Buddha would say, classically, so you just need to stop. I don't think he'd have much understanding, perhaps, of why it's got so complicated for us. He'd just say, you just need to stop. In his time, you were either, you know, embedded in a whole mesh of a massive extended family with all kinds of family responsibilities, or you were a celibate monk. There wasn't really any other options. So that's from his perspective. So that's what he'd say, I think. And probably wouldn't dress it up to make it pleasant for you. Just say, but do you not see how you're causing yourself suffering? And in a certain sense, that's what Buddhists should help teach. So a good friend of mine rang another friend of mine who's a very, very impressive practitioner, and he was talking about how, you know, he's very, very upset that his girlfriend had left him. And my friend said, "What did you expect? What did you expect? Did you really think it was going to go on for him? What did you expect?" And what he's trying to say there is, but do you not remember that things are impermanent? That this issue that the Buddha saw so clearly, that we're going to get old, that things that we cherish are going to be separated from us, we're going to get things we don't want, that is life. What did you expect? Now, if we look at it from our point of view, of course it's rather more difficult. It feels rather more difficult, doesn't it? So I would imagine very few people in this room can decide to stop having sex or romantic relationships. Hands up. No, perhaps a bit more. Most people, well, it would be very, very difficult. Sometimes that's thrust upon you, and it's incredibly painful, isn't it? There's nothing quite like the pain of a broken relationship when someone leaves you. It is one of the pains of human life and goes very, very deep indeed. And you can feel it when that happens to you, that it touches you at your deepest, it seems. You feel like you lose a part of yourself. And, well, yes, it's incredibly painful. So if you don't believe that it causes suffering, the Buddha would say, well, what about that? Yeah. But what are we going to do? So it seems to me that most of us can't just say, okay, fine. Most of us don't have that kind of insight to say, yes, it does cause suffering. In a sense, if you did, and if you had that insight in a very straightforward human way, not in a religious way, not in an ideological way, not because you want to be a nice person or a spiritual person, I don't think the Buddha was at all interested in all that nonsense. He just saw exactly how things are. If you saw it like that, you could. You could just stop. You just think, okay, look, this isn't going to work. If you were to really see that it was not ever going to work, you could stop. Because you stop doing lots of other things that are not going to work. And that's because you stop putting your hand on hot things because you know it hurts. We haven't had that degree of knowledge of lots of other parts of our life. But we haven't usually got that insight. So I think the Buddha would say, well, okay, so you need to cultivate the facilities to have that kind of insight. So first of all, you need to develop mindfulness. You need to practice meditation. You need to find better pleasures, for a start off. You need to educate yourself in pleasure. You need to just check, are you trying to find all your pleasures in this one person? Because tell you what, that's a really vulnerable thing to do. And you're making yourself very vulnerable to suffering. Are all your pleasures to do with being young? One of the things I've noticed is that so much of culture is geared towards youth. In a way, romantic love is a kind of young person's sport. And but are you doing things that you're going to still be able to be gaining pleasure from when you're old? You're probably not going to go to clubs anymore, but if you do, it'll be frankly embarrassing. The big moment for me was when I saw my older brothers dancing at my niece's wedding. Oh no, with a big billy bear bottom. Big beer belly. All they seem to do is you just bend your knees a bit, it seems. Too awful to watch. Are you cultivating pleasures? Are you finding pleasures that aren't to do with the romantic sexual nexus, as it were? Are you creating pleasures that are sustainable and will last you into old age? Are you cultivating interests which you'll still be able to deepen when you're 50, when you're 60, when you're 70? Someone like Tolstoy comes to mind. He learned to ride a bike when he was 72. Cezanne's great paintings all happened after he was 40. A modernising great novelist, Penelope Fitzgerald, she published her first novel when she was 61 and went on to win the Booker Prize and is now the Booker Prize winner's best Booker Prize winner, isn't it? She's a fantastic novelist. So, are you cultivating things that will deepen and deepen, or are you just cultivating this slice of time which will betray you, if you see what I mean? You'll find that all the things that you're into don't sustain. So the first thing you'd say is you need to educate yourself in pleasure. You actually need to find a much greater resources of pleasure in the natural world, in friendship, in art, in creative life. You need to urgently cultivate pleasure so that you don't get addicted to this one source, because especially in our culture, this everything in our culture seems to be obsessed with sex, just as Freud said it would be. So much of what you get pushed at you is really telling you that the sexual romantic thing is going to be the thing. So if you haven't got that, you haven't even got life, you've got nothing. You know? It's a terrible lie we're being sold, you know, which is why there's so many suicides around Christmas and New Year, etc., etc., one of the reasons. So the Buddha would say you need to urgently find new sources of pleasure that are sustainable, that you need to actually get on with practicing the spiritual life, so you start to get more of an insight into your predicament, which isn't the Buddha's predicament, it's not Buddhism's predicament, it's your predicament, it's my predicament, the predicament of getting old and dying. That is a really major issue you've got. If you haven't woken up to it yet, the Buddha's saying, tell you what, you need to wake up to that. That's what Buddha means, awake, wake up. Yeah? In a way, the Buddha's going around and just sort of knocking on your brain and telling you to wake up. So that's, in a way, the first things he would say, I think, is find more avenues into pleasure. One of the great ways of doing that is by learning meditation, cultivating meditation, because then you discover that you can find deeper and deeper pleasure within yourself. And you won't be able to let go of lesser pleasures until you find greater ones. I don't know about you, but I won't do anything anymore for ideological reasons. You know, it almost feels like the age of ideology has ended, doesn't it? The post-war, post-60s thing has kind of ended, and we need to find deeper ways of changing ourselves that ideology feels hollow. So perhaps that's enough to get on with, that we need to diversify our pleasure, find deeper pleasure, more sustaining pleasure, and we can find that in meditation, particularly in mindfulness, in art, in nature, in communication, in friendship, and that we need to cultivate the spiritual life so as to wake up to the situation that we're really in. And we really are in a situation. We are on the Titanic. The house that we're living in is burning, and the more mindfulness and more positivity we have, the more we can wake up to that. So that's trying to look at this issue of sex briefly from the point of view of the Buddha's experience, which is really very uncompromising. He's saying it's causing you suffering, give it up. And then I'm wanting to look at from the point of view of our experience, which is we haven't got the Buddha's experience yet. We can't be convinced there's this thing called enlightenment, which I'm going to have. We can't take it as a kind of given. What can we do from working from our side? And that is intensifying spiritual practice, learn spiritual practice, and cultivate pleasures. So that gives us 10 or 15 minutes for any questions. So let's hear some questions here.
I have two questions, really, but first of all, I want to know if I understood you correctly. You said something like we should never rely on other people to solve our problems in our relationships. Therefore, we should all try to be like full as a person and not rely on other people to solve our problems.
Yeah, let me explain, it's more complex than that. So I would certainly say, what I was trying to say is don't put all your eggs in one basket, because what happens when you drop it, or somebody runs off with it, if you see what I mean. So again, I'd say that one of the salient factors of modern Western life is it's got, our whole range of relationships have got narrowed. So we used to have much closer relationships. I mean, you read in Victorians, their relationship with their brothers and sisters is very, very strong, and very emotionally strong. There's a much greater range of relationship. There's an extended family, We've shrunk our world of relationships to two now, which is incredibly unstable. So I would say, if you want to do that, fine, but make sure you've got friendships, make sure you've got a whole range of relationships. But yes, you are trying to be not... The great danger is neurotic dependency. It makes you unhappy and it makes them unhappy. In a way, that's much more dangerous than sex. In a way, sex isn't that much of an issue in itself. It's a neurotic dependency that we need to be careful of. So you can be neurotically dependent, you can be neurotically independent, and you can be healthily dependent. No, I can't. Anyway, you can be neurotically dependent, can't you? And that's very often the case in sexual relationships. But you do get people who are neurotically independent. So sometimes you see this in the elderly, where they really do need you to help them, but they won't let you because they have to be independent. And it's a bit neurotic. You can be healthily dependent in the sense that you are dependent on a whole nexus of relationships, friends, lovers if you've got one, family and so on. There can be a healthy dependency and there can be a healthy independence. So you're trying to be healthily independent and healthily dependent and not neurotically dependent. Anyway, that kind of nuances it a bit more, doesn't it? The main point I was trying to say is don't put your eggs in one basket.
And also, you said if we have the secure relationship, then we lose all the excitement about...
I might be talking about my experience.
you can't get both.
You can't,
so from the Buddhist point of view, is there any compromise in that? Is it, possible...
Yes, I mean, I think this, you can't have both. It's true at every level of life. So if you want to be a mother and have a family... And you want to have a really high-flowing career, you've got a real problem there. Increasingly, we want both. That's causing more and more problems. Life can only give with one hand and take away with another. Inevitably, what you try and do is do both as well as you can. You know, you usually, in spiritual life, what you're trying to do is do things that actually the Buddha would say no not to do, and you're trying to do things that he would do. And you're hoping that gradually more and more of you is weighted towards what's in your truly best interest. But you can't just decide to do that. Inevitably, you end up doing both. Most people do. But you're trying to at least cultivate friendships and all that sort of thing outside of relationships.
Yeah, but I think it's easier to be a mum and have a career.
Yeah.
Sort of both.
Yeah,
it's
up to a point, yeah.
Quite impossible to have... relationship with someone, monogamous relationship, and have this.
Yes. Yeah.
It's important.
It's not impossible, but one of the great issues with human consciousness is that you get used to things. So they say, for instance, if you move to another country, it doesn't have any effect on your happiness level. So you went to, if you decide to move to Marbella, or you decide to, you think for a while you feel a bit happier, and then you get used to it. So it doesn't affect your happiness level. Your income has very little effect on your happiness level. Once you can afford to have a cup of coffee and a cake in town, any more income you have has negligible effect on your happiness level. And that's because we get used to things. So you can have the love of your life, the most beautiful, the most intelligent, or everything you ever wanted, and you'll get used to them. And because of you get used to them, the level of pleasure goes down. It's natural, otherwise we couldn't live. We habituate very, very quickly to things. So then that's why you suddenly think, I tell you what, I need to have an affair, or I need, because I got that excitement again. And that creates a new sort of problem, and so we go around. Yeah. So one of the issues with human life is you habituate. You habituate to pleasure, which means you have to keep on upping the ante of pleasure to get the same amount of pleasure. This is one of the issues with drugs. You know, the first time you take ecstasy, or LSD, or whatever, it's fantastic. But you have to keep on upping it to get the same buzz, because you habituate. Human beings habituate very, very quickly. You had a question at the back. I want to just make sure we're going round. Got a few minutes. Yeah.
Okay. The one thing that I want to say is the issues for us in the West, I suppose, pertaining to romantic situations that are apparent, and that the way we've constructed society is really unhealthy for rearing children.
Yes.
So I was wondering if the Buddhist perspective actually perceives, or within this, within Triratna, perceives that and looks at different constructions, or is working towards different solutions for raising children, because it's quite, it's very trapping for adults
and for the child and their experience of children. We're sort of aware of that, I think, quite deeply. I don't know that we've got very far with it.
That's just because it's sex creates babies, that's why.
Yes, right, yeah, but you're quite right to bring that up, but I don't think we've got very far with it. You know, we now have families and children's retreats, we've got a creche here every Wednesday and a group, in a class every Wednesday morning. we've had ideas about creating communities with people with families. No one's ever quite wanted to do that or quite got there with that. I think we're actually very early days with that, to be honest. The thing I would say is that people I know in our Sangha with children, there are quite a lot with children. There is a much greater sense of them being part of a community. I've got children in my life and I bring them here and they know lots of people. You know, they are part of a community. People know them. People know their parents. That people. I think we've made some inroads in that way, as there is a living community here at the centre, and children feel part of that. So they've got lots of people that they know. I think there's a much further to go. I think that is a really big issue generally, isn't it?
Well, I think it is at the moment the way society is structured.
That's right, yeah.
Leaning towards women than men.
Yeah.
But, I mean, as things progress and we leave financially both worlds.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And we've tightened our relationships down to this coupledom.
Yeah.
Thing. Actually, you know, it's a practice.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm practicing now because my children are older.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I feel now that I have the freedom to practice. So yeah, I'm yeah. Been waiting.
Yes, that's right.
To sort, yeah. Okay, here yeah. We go. I can get on with my spirituality. Because there never seems a way of me being able to create an environment that was conducive to bringing up children healthily. And I do know, and being part of fully a community.
Yeah, I take your point. I think we are working against a huge weight of tradition.
I was going to say, but isn't that a bit of an idealistic sort of notion, a bit like the romantic one? Couldn't you always use that?
Yeah.
I haven't got this, I haven't got that. So
absolutely, absolutely. You can always find reasons not to practice, and you can always find reasons not to.
Yes, I mean, it's an important point, isn't it? Because really, your practice has to be to do with your experience. I mean, a good friend of mine, his mother was dying, and you know, it's very, very difficult looking after her. He hardly got any sleep. She's very, very demanding. And he suddenly found himself saying, yes, but what about my spiritual practice? And a voice said, this is your spiritual practice. You know, to the degree to which you respond creatively or reactively to that, that is it. You know, that is it. What one somehow thinks that spiritual practice is this sort of fluffy thing away somewhere. But, you know, when the moment comes when your relationship says, tell you what, I've been having an affair all this time, or when the moment comes when your children leave home, or when your moment comes when a parent dies, that's the test of your practice. How much can you be creative and so on.
Yeah. So it's interesting when you mentioned that what the Buddha would say about the issue of sex, for example, and actually I thought a while ago I was thinking that actually he's probably right that we should just drop the whole thing and until the end of my life I should just...
We could all agree together.
No, but the thing is, in terms of sex, for example, for most people, I mean, or at least for a lot of people, it's not actually an addiction or something.
No,
it's more like a physical need or like something which is very natural, like food or shelter or drink. So how do you reconcile this kind of physical aspect of our life, which is very natural?
Yes, that's
what
right.
Would say?
Yeah, so I'm not trying to argue against a sort of healthy sex life and even a healthy sex drive. You see how it's so easy to get into a yes or no thing. So that's a bad thing. Actually, it's very, very healthy. It's just a sort of straightforward thing. And you enjoy it while you have it, if you see what I mean. I think pleasure itself is addictive. You always want it again, you always want more. I suppose what I'd say is that if that's what you want, great. And there's more to life. The danger of it is that, especially in our current context, everything becomes about that. Everything comes about the couple, everything comes about the loving relationship. And I just don't think that's helping us. I'm not then saying, and that's a bad thing, if you see what I mean. I'm mainly arguing for more of other things. Yes, more of other things, I think. But I'm not wanting a sort of neurotic attitude to sex. I think one of the great problems that we've been left with from our Judeo-Christian conditioning, from all sorts of other conditionings, is a kind of confusion about sex. So it's both too important and too bad at the same time. It'd be better to think of it like tennis. Yeah, no one said, oh, I wouldn't do that. I saw them playing tennis. You know, that would probably be better as a starting point rather than this terrible sort of, I don't know, thing that we can easily get into.
Yeah.
Hang on, I'll just get one over here for
just a general question. Matt, why is avoidance of suffering such an overwhelming drive? Or put it, you know, what's the term that is the big thing that you must shape your whole life to avoid situations where you suffer? Because, you know, coming back to children again, you know, the greatest devastation that can happen to me is one of my kids dying.
Of course, yeah.
But I, you know, that wouldn't lead me to say I will not have kids and live to the best of my ability because there's a potential of this colossal
hurt happening. Right. Cool.
And why?
Very good question.
Why is avoidance?
Yeah, yeah. I think it.
Not a sexual question.
No, it's not.
It's avoidance of potential suffering. Why should you shape your whole life to achieve that?
I mean, you can answer that from two ends. One is that, from our own, again, going back to where Buddhism starts, in terms of it starting with you, I'm being given the nod, it's because you just don't want to suffer. There's something in your heart of hearts that wants to be happy all the time, that is never satisfied until that's the case. There's something deep within you that wants life, fully life, and to be fully... We're like dry seeds yearning to be flowers, from a Buddhist point of view, that there's something within you that wants to be happy and never suffer at all. So I think one way of answering it is from that our side. Another is that the Buddha's saying, actually, folks, there's something fantastic out there. In fact, it's not even out there, it's in there. There's something in life that's so wonderful and precious that I can't extol it enough. There's so much more that you can experience. And then, what's getting in the way of that, if you see what I mean? So it depends, again, which way you're looking from it. If you look at it from our point of view, we don't want to suffer. Even when we get a cold or, you know, your daughter doesn't ring you on a mobile, you're immediately suffering and you don't want to suffer. And the other end of it is that Buddhism is saying there is actually something so much more, so incredible, that if you had even the slightest taste of it, you'd want to get rid of anything that got in the way of that. And that is also there in your experience, and the task of life is to find it. So look, I'm afraid there's lots of other questions, but I've been given the nod, and I was told off last time for going over the time. So let's leave it there.